From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 49 for Friday, the 28th of October, 2011. On the show this week...
Can I ask you just one? The question is, I've heard that minerals used in mobile phones is coming from the Eastern Congo.
I'm not familiar with what you're describing, so I need to do a little bit of research before I can give any answer on camera.
No interviews.
Why not? Press conference happening at 10:30.
10:30.
It's invite only, I'm afraid.
In 2009 and 2010, Frank Piersecki Paulsen travelled to the Democratic Republic of Congo to investigate a dark, bloody side to the mobile phone industry. We spoke to Paulsen, Nokia and US charity and experts in this field, The Enough Project, to investigate the story behind Paulsen's new film, Blood in the Mobile. But first, giant single-celled organisms, atmosphere hacking and the future of artificially induced orgasms as we cuddle up for a sexy squeeze with this week's Wired News. Hey, I'm Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me this week, news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
Of course he is. And associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
How's... I always ask you how you are. I already know how you are because I spoke to you like 2 minutes ago.
I'm still fine.
Okay.
But thanks for asking.
We've got a fairly Nokia-heavy week by coincidence this week. Not only is our feature about Nokia or a film that features Nokia, but also it was Nokia World and they announced some... Well, for once, some fairly exciting, or at least interesting, new devices.
Yeah, you don't sound terribly convinced by that.
We'll see if we're convinced. But later on, we're going to go head-to-head, or rather Siri, the iOS 5 voice command thing, and Iris, which is the Android equivalent. We're going to battle them and see who comes off better.
Iris, are you looking forward to your battle with Siri later?
Why don't we talk about something else?
I agree, Iris. Let's talk about the news. Let's talk about Nokia. Nokia World was this week, and they announced, or rather they showed off, their very first Windows Phone 7.5 phone. It's called the Nokia Lumia 800, and essentially what it is, if you've ever seen one, is a Nokia N9, which is a bit like a Nokia N8, but running Microsoft's Windows Phone operating system. This is the first Nokia phone, Duncan, with Windows Phone on it. On a scale of 1 to, yeah. How excited are you?
1.
Liv?
2.
Good. All right, we'll go with you then, Liv, because I played with it. I played with it yesterday, and it's quite nice. I mean, I said ages ago when the Nokia N8 came out that it was a gorgeous piece of hardware with a poor software running on it.
The Nate's a gorgeous piece of hardware.
The Nate. I always love that. And I always thought if it had Windows Phone 7 on it, it'd actually be a really good Windows Phone device. And at the time, there were very few of those. Duncan's looking so skeptical.
Yeah, because if it had Android on it, it would be brilliant. It's a fantastic bit of hardware.
You would say that about anything.
Okay, if it had iOS on it, it would be a fantastic piece of hardware. It would be better than an iPhone. It would be amazing.
You don't say that as much. But it is a fairly decent phone. It's going to be out in November. It's got all the usual Windows Phone features, but it has got also Nokia's hardware, which is one of the best things Nokia has ever produced, has been its hardware. So, yes, this will be out in November. Looks pretty cool. Let us know what you think if you've already seen it.
If not, go to wired.co.uk, search for Lumia 800 and you'll find it.
Do that. Anyway, let's move on that front. And let's talk about some juicy single-celled organisms found deep in the ocean.
Okay, so this is a team of marine biologists from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography who sent landing units down into the depths of the Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific back in July.
And that's the deepest point in any of the world's oceans, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, more than 10.5 kilometres below sea level, which is a long way down.
That's a deep organism.
It is. So these landers were equipped with digital video recorders and lights that were protected by a thick sphere of glass to kind of withstand the enormous pressures at those depths. But to their surprise, the researchers found xenophyophores, which are single-celled creatures that had never previously been seen before below 7,500 meters.
Wait, hang on. So how big are these things?
They are surprisingly big. They are single-celled creatures... Which, you know, you're thinking amoebas, you're thinking microscopic, you're thinking you can only see them under a microscope.
Can you see in my mind? Because that is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking as well.
I can see a microscope in your mind. But no, these have a diameter that often exceeds 10 centimetres.
So that's something you could That's like what? How big is 10 centimetres coin-wise? I'm trying to think. It's much bigger than any coin, isn't it?
It's about 10 centimetres big.
All right. That's, yeah. That's I was never good in school.
And so they're just sitting at the bottom of the ocean there and acting as a host for a variety of organisms. They don't actually do very much. They have some of the largest single cells known to mankind.
Imagine if that was a skin cell. Imagine how big you'd be.
You'd be.
If you scaled it up.
I'd be huge.
That would be awesome.
I'd be enormous, Liv. Thanks.
But what do they do?
They just sit there and they.
How do they withstand the pressure?
Oh, they don't need to. Well, they do need to, but, you know, they just sit there.
Before we move on, though, from this, what's interesting about this is that the Mariana Trench is actually one of the places that Richard Branson is heading down to in his new single-manned pod at some point over the next 5 years, I think, which we talked about in a previous show. So this stuff that required this amazing piece of kit to go down, that's basically a robot, we're going to get to see these again when old Richie B goes down with his robo-claws.
The megacells weren't actually the only things that the landers found. They also found the deepest jellyfish that has been observed to date, which you can see gliding happily past on a video, which is on wired.co.uk.
Oh, I actually haven't seen that video.
Would you like to?
I'm going to.
Well, then go to wired.co.uk.
I might, but not before we talk about a river in Wales, which has had a bridge built over the top of it, made entirely out of plastic from 50 tons of recycled plastic waste. Only in Wales, Duncan. Only in Wales would they make a bridge out of plastic.
No, that seems a bit harsh to our Welsh listeners. This is a startup called Vertec, who are kind of trying to build an industry out of recycling plastic waste into construction materials.
Waste not, want not.
Waste not, want not, indeed. They've made this bridge, which is 30 metres long. It's a footbridge, but it can kind of cope with, you know, not an articulated lorry, but, you know, a bit of construction equipment or something. They've put it over the Tweed River.
And can you move it? I mean, if it's made out of plastic, it can't be that heavy. So can you, like, take it down and can you move it?
It's pretty hefty because this is kind of condensed. It's a thing called thermoplastic, which is, it doesn't rust. It doesn't need regular maintenance. You don't have to paint it. It just kind of quietly sits there, doesn't decay. And handily, it's also 100% recyclable. So if you get bored of your bridge, you can pick it up, recycle it, move it somewhere else.
This company, Vertec, why are they doing this?
Well, I mean, what they're doing is they teamed up with engineers from Rutgers and Cardiff Universities to build this bridge. But what they actually want to do is make these recycled thermoplastic products more widely available across Europe in the construction sector to replace materials like timber and things like that are being used that aren't particularly environmentally friendly.
Cool. Well, we're going to bridge a gap here with a little ad break. And when we come back, we're going to shell out on some new tech for crabs.
Wired magazine, now published digitally every month on iPad. Download the latest interactive issue, available now on the iTunes App Store.
So, Liv, you told me a lovely little story earlier. Well, it was heartwarming and touching about crabs and not having a house and how a company was going to 3D print some new ones.
Yeah. You may or may not know, but there is a hermit crab housing crisis on at the moment. They can't find enough places to live, and so they're using things like old shotgun cartridges or glass bottles as their homes.
Poor little things.
Yeah, exactly. But the MakerBot community has stepped in. This is a kind of 3D printing community who've stepped in to launch a competition to design a new crab home that could be 3D printed and given to these little crabettes.
And they've had some already, haven't they? And they've tested it in a tank.
What they've got at the moment, you can go and see on their website, they have a tank filled with crabs, some with home, some without, and they're putting in the alternative houses, different shell designs, some of them very traditional shapes, some of them a bit more Shoreditch, and the crabs can choose whether they like them or not, and they'll work out which ones are successful, and then they'll start printing a load of them off.
And then what, dump them in the sea?
Well, they haven't actually made any strict plans so far, but they're talking about that's the next stage would be to put them into the sea.
It's kind of like Pimp My Shell.
Yeah.
And this thing has an amazing name.
It has a pretty amazing name. It's called Project Shelter. I hope you detected the additional L in that word.
I think we all did.
Good.
Okay. I certainly did, Liv, but thanks for checking. Let's move on and talk about hacking the atmosphere. Duncan, you know so much about this.
Geoengineering.
Yeah. There was a poll, I think, done, and some people said, yeah, let's hack the atmosphere.
Yeah, and it's kind of a terrible idea, and I'm going to try and explain why. Geoengineering is basically about doing big-scale things to our climate to try and solve global warming problems. So that could be something as little as injecting nutrients into the ocean so that plants grow and then they suck down the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, or it could be putting a giant mirror in space.
I was going to say, having a giant mirror on the moon or floating around the Earth is my idea of geoengineering.
Yeah, and there's an enormous kind of scale of things in between. So they've suggested kind of injecting tiny particles into the stratosphere, or whitening clouds, or even just using kind of pale coloured roofing and paving materials at a ground level to try and make the Earth a little bit more reflective and bounce some of that sunlight back into space.
So this totally scientific and fair study that was performed on the internet showed a kind of high degree of support for doing such things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to cast aspersions on their process because I haven't, you know, examined it enormously closely. But there, according to 3,105 individuals from the US, from Canada and the UK, weighted to be representative of the wider population, 72% were broadly in favour of, going for this.
But I think what Liv said before the show, and that breath might have been her about to repeat what she said.
Yeah, well, I just think it's so hard to ask members of the public about these huge issues. I mean, first of all, these are all techniques that haven't really been tried or tested in the first place. And you're asking people, do you want to save the environment and reverse climate change? Here are some of the options which scientists are giving you. And you're like, yeah, hell yeah, I want to stand up and fix this shit.
Well, again, you know, we haven't actually seen the questions that they did ask. They did say that the measured familiarity with the topics was actually quite high. 8% of people knew what geoengineering was, and 45% knew what climate engineering was before it was explained to them.
But have any of these things been done on any kind of scale before?
No. There's an early trial.
Do you know what humanoid robots are, or do you know what's, living on the moon is like?
There's an early trial due to take place reasonably soon, which involves kind of injecting water particles with a balloon up into the atmosphere. And there's been an enormous amount of controversy within the scientific community about that project.
Oh, really? How come?
Just because people are, worried about the effects that it's going to cause. The thing is, climate is an incredibly complicated system, and it's not a system that we understand very much yet. And so doing these, large-scale things to the climate, there's, very, very likely to be enormous unintended effects.
So what was the point in asking me and your average person in the street what they wanted to do with it then?
Well, what they want to do is just kind of gauge some kind of level. It's the kind of first major study of what people think about geoengineering. Nobody's actually asked the public that question before. So it's a first attempt to try and gauge what the kind of level of public support for this is.
Okay. Let us know what you think if you have support and you are the public. podcast@wired.co.uk. We're going to very quickly talk about sex, aren't we, Liv?
Yeah, I spoke to a futurologist called Ian Pearson, who told me that by about 2030, he wasn't particularly specific about the exact year, we will be able to record sensory experiences, such as like the physical experience of having sex, and then you'll be able to relive them at a later date, either by wearing some kind of weird sex suit or possibly by having some kind of chip in your brain that would recreate the same kind of stimuli that you had originally, or even didn't have originally, someone else had, and you just get to experience them.
So what's the technology behind this?
Well, there isn't any technology behind it, to be honest, Duncan. This is all a little bit it's more of a kind of thought experiment based on he does link it to some technologies that are available now, but we're very much jumping quite a long way ahead of what we've got now. He cited a recent Barclays study where they got participants to watch different YouTube videos and monitored their brain activity. And then they then got them to watch the videos again, and they judged what the videos they were watching were based purely on the patterns that they saw emerging in their brain, and then recreated the images that they were seeing. And it wasn't perfect, but you kind of get the sense that you might be able to recreate the visual experience of something by probing different parts of the brain.
And yeah, I think that ties in quite well. I mean, we covered that in the podcast a few weeks ago.
We did.
And one of the really weird kind of things that he considered was this idea that you'd be able to download someone else's experience. So a man might be able to feel what the woman that he was having sex with was at the same time by wearing some kind of suit, so he'd know whether he was doing the right thing or not, and wouldn't have to rely on guesswork.
And could you say save it and download other people's?
Yes.
I mean, I say yes. The answer to all of these questions are yes. Yes, you maybe could.
Yes, in 2030, this could all happen. You know, he talks about having libraries of celebrity porn stars' kind of sexual experiences that you could download.
I wonder if you could apply the same sort of thinking to other experiences, though. I mean, we're talking about sex as a pleasurable thing, but there could also be, I guess, if you had pain from some kind of an illness that you could use to describe to a doctor, yeah. Or if you were some kind of crazy masochist.
I've just got a wonderful image in my head of the GP's surgery office. Can you show me how it hurts? Ow! Ow! Yeah. Damn, that does hurt.
Yeah. Well, at least you'd get a more objective view of what pain was. You'd have to have the pain monkeys. Pain monkey, we're going to administer some pain.
What?
I think there's something else that could be learnt from all this as well, which is that if someone was unable to describe a pain or an experience or something, then perhaps you could record it and essentially play it back on yourself. This is all very weird.
Yeah.
Can I just say?
And we've drifted quite far off the original topic now.
We have. I don't think he'll be held to account if this doesn't happen by 2030, but it's an interesting thought experiment nevertheless.
Well, I want my pain monkey.
Well, Liv, you have a story on the site now, and I think if you go to wired.co.uk and search for
sex,
yeah, then you'll probably find it. The iPod is 10 years old this month, and it's kind of amazing how far it's come when you consider the origins of the iPod. The very first iPod had 5 gigabytes of storage, or 10, and cost just under £300, and had a mechanical scroll wheel. Anyway, the reason we're talking about iPods is because the iPhone is kind of the most advanced iPod, I guess, you can get, and on the new iOS 5 it has a feature called Siri, which is like a voice command. We've all read about it, I'm sure.
Yeah, most people know what it is. Do you want to give a quick demonstration of what it does?
Yeah, basically, I can hold up my phone and do this. Wake me up at 7 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Okay, I set it for 7 a.m.
Actually, cancel that alarm.
Which alarm should I delete?
Alarm at 7 a.m.
Here's the alarm. It's set for 7 a.m.
As you can see, it doesn't work perfectly all the time.
It works very well. And the other day, I did use it very effectively to call my girlfriend while I was walking up a rainy street with my wireless headset. Just, call Poppy. Where shall I call her? Home. Calling Poppy at home. It was very effective and it worked. But it's not always perfect. And the Android didn't have this feature, but it does have
The Android.
Yeah, the Android OS.
Okay. Yeah, a bunch of coders in about 8 hours, I think, hacked together a kind of an Android equivalent of Siri called Iris that I guess it's kind of a clone of the design, and they use the voice functions that are inbuilt into Android at a very low level.
Plus it's Iris, which is Siri backwards.
Yes.
How very Siri.
I hope most of our readers would have got that before you mentioned it. But maybe some of them didn't.
Maybe some. They all do now. Thanks, yeah. Duncan. We wanted to, the whole point for all this long, convoluted mission to go from iPods being 10 years old, explaining what Siri is, and then doing what we're doing now, is because we wanted to put them head to head and see how effective they are against each other.
Death match.
Because Iris only came out this week or last week, I think.
Yeah, this week.
So that's why it's timely, people. That's why it's timely.
So what we're going to do is we've got a set of 5 questions. We're going to ask Iris and Siri the same question and see what they come up with. Is everybody ready?
Liv, you can be the... Who is that guy in Gladiators, the Scottish bloke?
Duncan, let's start with the first question for Iris.
Okay. The first question is, Iris, how are you?
Every minute, I get around a terabyte of new information to study. Give me a break.
Kind of petulant and annoyed.
Nate, let's see how Siri compares.
Okay. How are you?
I am well.
That was good.
Lovely.
Perfect answer.
Yeah.
I think that's a firm 1-0 to Siri.
So we've got a mathematical round now. Duncan?
Yeah, maths question now. We're going to go with Iris. What's 30% of 5,300?
I think, Iris, what is a lot of things?
Oh,
what?
Okay. No idea what that is. Let's see if Siri does it any better. What is 30% of 5,300?
This might answer your question.
And I have 1590 on my screen.
1590 is correct.
No, wait, and I've judged it and it is correct.
And I have a graph. Oh. And I have...
A graph of what?
Well, you can see. Just some charts. We'll cut this.
That's just a number line.
It's an answer. That's more than I got from your crappy clone.
That's 2-0, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, pizza question.
Iris, What's a good pizza restaurant near Times Square?
That seems like a lot.
A lot of what?
Okay, great. Okay, my turn now. What's a good pizza restaurant near Times Square?
I can only look for businesses in the United States. And when you're using US English, sorry about that.
Do an American accent.
I can't. But I think we should point out the reason why we use Times Square, which is in New York, I think, isn't it?
It's so that they could look it up in the United States.
So they can look it up in the US, because both of these work best with businesses in the US. Okay, so nil-nil on that one anyway. Next one, a bit of a romance.
We're going into relationships here and troubled relationships. Iris, should I leave my husband?
If you love something, set it free. If it comes back to you, it's yours. If it doesn't, it never was.
Oh.
That's good.
Okay, that's beautiful.
That's a good answer.
That's great advice.
I like that one.
Good work, Iris.
Okay, that's a point. Let me try Siri now. Should I leave my husband?
I don't know what you mean by, should I leave my husband?
But it does give me the option of doing a web search, so I'm going to count that as a nil score.
Nil point.
It's interesting. The
Or should I leave my husband?
Oh, it's bringing up a Safari page now. So it's trying.
Yeah. It's quite interesting how the husband, the male voice, doesn't really understand this concept of leaving your husband, whereas the lady voice, if you love something, set it free.
He's not very open-minded then, is he?
And then finally, we have one more round. We are going with a more philosophical question. Iris, how many roads must a man walk down before you can call him a man?
Let us change the subject.
Right.
That's no. The phone equivalent for running away.
Yeah.
Right, okay, let's try the last one then for Siri. How many roads must a man walk down before you can call him a man?
Let me check on that.
Wait.
This might answer your question.
What is it?
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind.
No way.
Yeah.
Is that a Google search?
Excellent.
No, it's integrated. Look.
Wow.
Well, it looks like we have a pretty clear winner.
Winner.
3-1 to Siri.
Yeah, in every facility apart from relationships.
In which case, Iris gave a lovely piece of advice.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah.
My favourite one to do is this one. What is the meaning of life?
All evidence to date suggests it's chocolate.
That's brilliant.
Thanks, Siri. You're the best.
Was it something I said?
Well, pretty much, yeah. So anyway, that's our thing that we did.
We're going to have to come up with a better name for it than that.
Future things will be called maybe a thing off.
Mm. Thanks. Or that. Thing versus thing.
But on that note, that ends our feature and our news. And we're going to take it down a little notch as we go deep into Katie's investigation behind the claims made by the new film, Blood in the Mobile.
In 2009 and 2010, Danish filmmaker Frank Piasecki Poulsen travelled to the Democratic Republic of Congo. He wanted to investigate the link between minerals used for components in mobile phones and the civil war in DR Congo, one he describes as the bloodiest since the Second World War. In the resultant documentary, Poulsen argues that some of the minerals used by technology manufacturers are being excavated in makeshift mines and the profits are financing the war. But why did he make a documentary, and why did he focus his quest for answers so specifically on Nokia? We wanted to find out, but first we talked to the filmmaker about his journey to the mine deep in the forest of the Walikale and what he found there.
Yeah, I went to Congo several times in order to make this film, and the first time was just to mainly to see if I could access one of these mining areas, because they are in very remote places deep in the jungle. So what we did was we went to the capital of the North Kivu province, Goma, and from there we flew with helicopter like 200 kilometers into the jungle. And the UN said, okay, anything, no matter what happens, we won't be able to come and rescue you if you continue from here. And so we still continued like a couple of hundred kilometers on motorbikes, and then we walked for 2 days into the jungle in order to access one of the biggest illegal mines in the Congo, which is called BCE. It's a strange place. It has just in a few years it has grown from when they discovered these minerals just a few years before. And when I was there the first time, there was in between 15,000 to 25,000 people living in mud and plastic bags. You know, it's like really a strange place, and the armed groups, the armed group who was in control of the place, they just built like a gate in front of the mine where everybody has to pass through and inside it's like it looks like you know, so many slum quarters around the world. Only this is the thing, is that the prices of everything are so high. So the people, they have to, all the people that come and they want to find work, they get inside, they have to pay to get inside, and then everything, they are priced so hard on because the armed groups are taxing everything, so they have to pay, like, you know, a beer costs $7-$8, a kilo of meat costs $15, stuff like that. So they have to use all the money that they make inside the mine. And of course the armed groups are, you know, skimming off the cream from this.
Upon his return to Europe, Paulson decided to approach Nokia simply because he'd always used their phones to find out their policy on the use of blood minerals.
First of all, I wrote them a nice letter saying that I had been to Congo and I wanted to make a film about this. I was interested in working with them to follow their work in trying to solve this problem. And I was quite surprised when they didn't answer back, and when they finally, after sending the mail a few times, they finally sent me a 2-line email saying that they didn't have the resources to participate in such a project. I initially wanted to work with Nokia, to be inside Nokia, seeing how they were trying to solve this problem, and I think that would have been a much more interesting film if they would actually have opened up to me. Because then I could go with them to meetings in this industry, on the industry level, in Jesse, and see how they were preparing for a meeting, trying to persuade the other electronic producers to really act on this. And in that sense, you could say that Nokia had every chance of being the heroes of this film.
But, argues Mika Kiskinen, Nokia's director of social responsibility, the phone manufacturer's portrayal in the documentary is unfair.
The film gives a misleading picture of Nokia, and the accusations are not based on facts or any evidence.
Kiskinen has been working for several years on how the company can avoid using blood minerals, but admits that it's a complicated issue and isn't going to be solved simply by making the mineral buying process more transparent, something Paulson calls for in the documentary.
We have worked now more than 10 years to make sure that the raw materials are not originating from the conflict areas, and so far we haven't found any cases where that would have been the case. And the question related to transparency, there are typically 4 to 8 suppliers between Nokia and any mining activities, and if we just disclose our first tier, that wouldn't really solve the problem, because we can't require our suppliers to provide their supplier information. Furthermore, the challenge of traceability is much lower down in the supply chain, which means at the mining and extraction supply chain. So the thing is really to concentrate on the smelters, and that is actually something which has happened after the film.
Nokia, he explains, has been working on this issue since 2001, the same year that GESI, the Global E-Sustainability Initiative, was founded. Alongside the Washington-based Electronic Industry Citizenship Coalition, GESI has created the Conflict-Free Smelter Assessment Program and a Conflict Minerals Reporting Template tool to help companies do their due diligence on where the minerals that they are using in their devices come from. As of the 30th September, dozens of smelting companies were participating in the Conflict-Free Smelter Program, and half of these have been deemed compliant. And Nokia has signed up. This, Kiskinen argues, will be far more effective than attempting to scientifically fingerprint the minerals before they go to the smelting factories, a methodology pushed forward in the film.
It was not really a reliable one, and quite a lot of questions around it, and can it be really trusted?
Politicians seem to be endorsing a policy of industry cooperation. The European Commission is backing the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, but has also not ruled out imposing sanctions on individuals and entities supporting illegal armed groups in DR Congo through the illicit trade of natural resources. On the 25th of October, Brussels issued details of a package of measures to support responsible business practice, and these include a system of country-by-country reporting to record payments made by extractive and logging businesses to governments all over the world. The proposals will be passed to the European Parliament and the EU's Council of Ministers for adoption and should be rolled out over the next 2 years. Stateside, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act was signed by President Obama in July. As a result, American companies will be required to certify whether their products contain minerals from militia-controlled mines in DR Congo. A report in the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail argues that this is causing panic among manufacturers scared of facing public anger, and some are already opting to buy their minerals from other continents other than Africa. But, says Kiskinen, Nokia is not going to do this.
We have done quite a lot of progress after this film. Now there are some companies down there who are avoiding sourcing any minerals from Central Africa because it's easier to get somewhere else. They don't have to provide that much work or evidence that where the mineral is coming from. So we have gone to OECD pilot, which is concentrating on creating sustainable supply chains.
Back to the US, where we caught up with Aaron Hall, policy analyst from the Enough Project, a charity and pressure group that played a key part in the creation of the new Dodd-Frank Act. The group, which runs an initiative called Raise Hope for Congo, makes policy recommendations to the US State Department and National Security Council on the strength of reports from staff on the ground in Congo. Hall argues that any manufacturer claiming it can't trace the minerals used in its devices is simply not trying hard enough.
Companies have known about this for a long time. I mean, really since 2001, I think it was when the connection between the tantalum trade in Congo and I think the Sony PlayStation consoles, when the first Sony PlayStations came out, the linkages were made. And companies, in fact, reacted very quickly to that and tried to mitigate blowback that they were getting from consumers on the issue, asking them what they were doing about it, what the issue was, you know, that type of thing. And so they've known since that point, and they took action at that point. And then when the issue came up again, around that time in 2007, 2008, up until the situation we have now, they've taken action again. And so, you know, to say that this is something that's new, first of all, is a falsehood. They've known about it for a long time, and when pushed, have taken action. And to say that it can't be done is also a falsehood, because in fact, some companies have already done it. While that argument that this can't be done or it's too complex was prominent at the beginning, the further down the road we get towards actually having a framework on the ground, the less viable that argument is becoming.
In fact, says Hall, we could have a conflict mineral-free phone in the next year or so, as so much has happened since Blood in the Mobile was filmed.
I saw Blood in the Mobile sometime back. It's been a while. You know, we saw advanced copies, and I know that since that movie was made, and where we're at today, there's been a lot of progress and there's been a lot of debate on the issue. From the U.S. standpoint, you know, the legislation that was kind of the impetus, like I said, for a lot of the progress on the ground had come out, and the SEC is getting ready to, the Securities and Exchange Commission here in the U.S. is getting ready to hand down regulations for publicly listed companies in the United States. That's going to go a long way in driving more action on the ground, and local partners on the ground have taken a number of steps to start doing programs where they're bagging and tagging minerals, where they're setting up frameworks for independent monitors, where they're working with regional countries to set up harmonized systems to get conflict-free minerals out of the region, which, you know, in turn creates a legitimate system, puts revenue back into communities and things like that. So we're seeing a lot of positive developments.
While he admits this is a problem that isn't going to go away, Hall argues that we could be optimistic about the future and hopeful that the mining practices in countries like DR Congo can be changed without devastating that country's economy.
I don't want to paint a rosy picture where, you know, that's where everything's going to work out great and we don't have to do anything anymore. I mean, it's going to be a challenge. It requires coordination amongst lots of different stakeholders, and it takes a long time, you know, to agree upon standards and rules and regulations. But the kind of bureaucratic inertia is moving forward, and you know, historical precedent would show that when that type of bureaucratic inertia, whether it's within the EU or the U.S. government or the regional bodies in Africa, the ICGLR, OECD, whoever, that tends to not stop. And so it's a moment of opportunity based on the fact that people are paying attention, people are trying to solve problems. This is an issue that's on the radar of a number of governments, very, very senior level policymakers in the U.S. and Europe and Africa, and in the boardrooms of huge multinational corporations across the globe. And so when you've got that kind of inertia, you've got an opportunity to have a positive impact, and that's where we're at right now.
Blood in the Mobile is being screened in Bath, Belfast, Edinburgh and London, but there are more details on the film's Facebook page, facebook.com/bloodinthemobile. But if you've seen the film, please do let us know your views at the usual address. For the wired.co.uk podcast, I'm Katie Scott.
Katie Scott there, and the usual address, of course, is podcast@wired.co.uk. We're going to now move on to our feedback. It's the end of the show, so we've asked some people what they thought of some things on Facebook. Duncan, you asked them this. I don't even know what the question was.
The question was, have you got anything to ask Nate, Liv and Duncan?
Oh, right. What did Richard Berry, he's first on the list. What did he want to know from us?
Yeah, he said, people I work with are starting to get into Prezi, which is, I've just looked it up. It's a kind of zooming in cross between a whiteboard and presentation software. It looks quite snazzy. But is everyone catching on to it as well? Are we stuck with PowerPoint?
Well, I have to say, I don't know the last time I used PowerPoint. It's inferior to Keynote on the Mac. So I use that for the very few times I need to use it.
But I think in most offices, it's pretty pervasive.
Yeah, it's pretty standard, well, I think.
He asked me. That's my answer. I haven't used it for about 10 years.
Okay, but if you have a PC, you're probably likely to use PowerPoint.
What do you think, Liv? Do you think we're stuck with PowerPoint forever?
I think we're not stuck with it forever, but I think it's going to be so hard to change it because it's something that's so pervasive in huge corporations.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, everybody's buying kind of office software, so yeah.
But we saw Tom Hume did quite a cool presentation at the Wired conference, didn't he, where it was all you could track it in real time on a website.
Yeah, that was really cool. And I've also seen kind of an increase lately in people presenting with nothing behind them at all, just actually speaking off notes, which is a really difficult thing to do. And it's nice that it's kind of making a bit of a comeback.
Who else has emailed us or asked us?
On Facebook, a page called No Email Day asked us for our thoughts on No Email Day, which is a campaign on the 11th of November for avoiding email totally for 24 hours so you can focus on getting work done. What do you think about that, Nate?
Hang about. Most of my work is email. I think about 80% of my day, and let's be to anyone who wants to become a website editor, most of your job will involve answering emails.
I think the point is that if you don't answer emails for 24 hours, then that's not more things being added to your to-do list. You can actually get on with the stuff that you
and
would otherwise have
innovating.
Been doing.
I remember the guy, Scott Belsky, who is the CEO of the Behance Network, always talks about some of the most successful entrepreneurs will not open their email for the first few hours of the day, and they'll just focus on like new projects, coming up with new ideas,
getting
and not
stuff
getting
done.
Like bogged down in the kind of drudgery of daily email life.
I'd love to do that, actually. The more I think about it, the more attractive it sounds.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate email.
I think a day,
I'm rubbish
though,
at it.
I think maybe a no email hour would be about as much as I could tolerate before I freaked out.
Yeah, it's called lunch.
And then finally, Jerome Turner asked if we've got any thoughts on this year's prediction of big Christmas gift toys.
Ah, what's
that's
a toy?
An interesting one.
I want towels for Christmas.
You want towels?
Yeah. I'm a grown-up.
I mean, I don't know an awful lot about the gift toy market this year, to be quite honest with you.
No.
Probably Kinect. Again.
What's wrong with Lego? I know it's not really...
Lego's a classic. Nothing is wrong with Lego. It is the perfect toy.
Or My Pony. Is it called My Pony?
It's called My Horse.
My
it
horse.
Starts life as a pony, as you know, but it goes to a horse eventually.
Do you want to explain to people what this actually is?
Oh, it's an app on a phone where it's kind of like, imagine the world's most advanced Tamagotchi. It's that as an app with horses for the iPhone.
I just say, as a resident horse expert, horses don't start off as ponies. They're completely different things.
Really?
Yeah,
horses start as foals. Ponies are just small horses.
True,
but they also
or foals?
As...
Sorry.
In next week's horse news.
Okay.
Was that off the hoof?
let's move.
I say nay to that.
Let's move on to the main part of the rest of the podcast.
If you want to drop us any questions, facebook.com/wired UK. And of course, questions always welcome in email, podcast@wired.co.uk. And we have Twitter. Someone tell me what that is.
It's @wired UK, which we fill up every day with lots of exciting futuristic goodness.
And also, if anyone missed our Wired 2011 event the other week, we are now posting videos of all the talks on the website. So if you go to wired.co.uk/11, you'll start seeing all the videos in full for free. Popping up on the website to watch in full, and they work on iPads and iPhones and other phones too. So, and I think on that note, we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
I am bored right now, and I don't feel like answering your questions.
She's got a really annoying voice as well. Yeah.